From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. One of the Oscar nominees in the category of Best Foreign Language Film is the German movie The Lives of Others. It's won 7 Lola Awards, the German equivalent of the Oscar, including Best Film, Best Screenplay, and Best Director. Set in East Germany from 1984 to 91, it's about a captain in the secret police and the artists he spied on. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear from the director of the film, Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck. Also, we listen back to an interview with singer Frankie Lane. He died yesterday at the age of 93. And Ken Tucker reviews the debut CD by Lily Allen. It's been a big hit in Europe and was just released here. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. While filmmakers in Germany have explored the nation's Nazi past from a variety of perspectives in recent years, little serious attention has been paid to the years of communist rule in East Germany, especially the oppressive surveillance of the Stasi, the German Democratic Republic's secret police. The Stasi recruited and pressured informants to spy on their friends, family, and neighbors on a scale unprecedented even in the communist world. Many citizens had no idea who was informing on them until after the fall of the Berlin Wall, when Stasi records were opened for public review. The effect of Stasi surveillance on its targets and its spies is the subject of a new widely acclaimed film by our guest Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck. It's called The Lives of Others, and it tells the story of a loyal Stasi captain who begins to question his commitment when he's assigned to spy on two famous artists, a playwright and his actress girlfriend. The Lives of Others is von Donnersmarck's first feature film. It won 7 Lola Awards, the German Oscars, and it has an Oscar nomination for Best Foreign Language Film. He spoke with Dave Davies, who frequently guest hosts Fresh Air.
Well, Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, welcome to Fresh Air. I wonder if you could begin, before we talk about how you conceived and made this film, with just giving us, our audience, a sense of the scale of the surveillance and brutality of the Stasi, the East German Secret Service.
Yeah, the Stasi was the vastest, most extensive secret service in the history of mankind, with 300,000 employees monitoring a population of only 17 million people. That's quite a small population. That's only just about twice the size of New York. And imagine 300,000 people trying to find out every aspect of people's lives. It was an organization that defined itself against the Gestapo. Very often people now say it was just like the Gestapo. Well, I mean, they defined themselves against it, which is why it was not an organization that used much physical violence. It used psychological violence. You know, while at the Gestapo, the Gestapo recruited thugs who would break people's bones, and the Stasi recruited intelligent psychologists who would break people's spirits.
I know that you have an interesting background. I mean, you spent part of your childhood in New York and then lived for many years in West Berlin, which is, of course, mm-hmm. was part of West Germany but surrounded by East German countryside. What contact did you have with East Germany and East Germans, and how much awareness did you have of the Stasi as a child?
Well, I had quite a lot of awareness because both of my parents are from the East, came over before the wall was built. But we had family and friends in Eastern Germany. Actually, an uncle of my father's was even chief of protocol for Erich Honecker's, the communist general secretary's office. And we often visited the East, and my parents were on special Stasi lists because they were considered traitors to the communist cause. And so at the border were... I remember one time when I was about 8 years old and my brother was 9, we drove over with our mother, and my mother was just led out of the car and disappeared in one of those buildings with these people for hours, and then came back all shaky and told us that she'd been strip-searched and humiliated in all kinds of possible ways. And my brother and I just thought this was, you know, very strange and somehow amazing that an organization could have so much power that they would be allowed to strip our mother.
How old were you?
I was 8. and also, you know, traveling to the East and seeing our friends there, how they were looking over their shoulders, trying to see who was seeing us talking to them, because they knew that this could damage their careers greatly, and it probably did. You know, all that, just seeing adults in fear of the Stasi. We knew that it was the Stasi that they were afraid of. That all made a very strong impression on me and certainly informed, well, if not my film, then at least my research for the film. I knew that the way that the GDR was portrayed throughout all those films that have already been made that are nostalgic of that era, that wasn't really a very accurate portrayal, that there was a very dark side to it too that needed to be portrayed.
Now, I read that part of the inspiration for this story, I mean, you wrote and directed this remarkable film, I read that part of the inspiration for the story was something that you read about Lenin, the Bolshevik revolutionary, mm-hmm. listening to a Beethoven sonata. Explain that moment and how it led to this idea.
Lenin had few close personal friends, and one of his closest friends actually was Maxim Gorky, the Russian writer. And after Lenin's death, Gorky wrote that Lenin had once told him, actually the quote goes something like this, he says, "The Appassionata is my favorite piece of music," Lenin says, "but I don't want to listen to it anymore, because if I do listen to it, and when I do listen to it, it makes me want to stroke people's heads and tell them nice, stupid things, but I have to smash in those heads, bash them in without mercy in order to finish my revolution." And, you know, I thought, so this is what Lenin feels like. Now, let's see if I can find a way to force Lenin to listen to the Appassionata. And out of that, I constructed this idea of a man just sitting there with earphones on his head and expecting that through these earphones he's going to hear words of his ideological enemies, but actually he's hearing music that is so beautiful that it actually makes him rethink that ideology. That was the basic idea for the film. And so Lenin changed into a Stasi officer who's sitting in a surveillance center monitoring people, and so who would be, you know, playing that kind of beautiful music if not artists? So I kind of knew that was going to be the basic setting, a Stasi officer monitoring artists and changing through that close proximity with them.
And so we have this film whose central character is a captain in the Stasi who is conducting surveillance on a playwright and his actress girlfriend, and mm-hmm. kind of being very moved by what happens in their lives. He overhears intimate moments.
And he just basically becomes part of their lives. They don't know that he's wiretapped their entire apartment and that there are bugs everywhere, even in the bathroom. And so they really go on leading their normal lives, and he takes part in that. And he's a Stasi captain who's so far been a specialist in interrogations. And of course, you know, in an interrogation situation, you never have someone just in their normal lives. Someone you don't have the opportunity to compare that to your own life, but because you're just always seeing them in that very same stress situation. But here, he suddenly has, you know, this daily contrast of seeing how his life works and how these people's lives works, and I've often intercut it in that way, and you know what this artist's work is and what his work is, so that does make him change and think.
And the actor who played him, Ulrich Muha, do I have the name pronounced?
Yeah, pretty good. I mean, the sound which is in his last name doesn't actually exist in the English language, so it's actually Ulrich Muha.
All right.
Yeah, it's one of those totally unpronounceable names.
with apologies to that, I mean, I read that he, because he was an artist who had grown up in East Germany, had actually had mm-hmm. some experience of being spied on by the Stasi, as so many artists did. And I wondered if that made making this film an emotionally difficult experience for him, or if it informed his performance in some way.
Yeah, I think, you know, Ulrich Muha is a really very courageous man, and he was one of the first people to ask for his Stasi files. He was not like 90% of the GDR population, even of those who were monitored by the Stasi, that they say, look, we don't want to know what's in the past. We just want to look into the future and not know who of our neighbors and friends or family betrayed us. Ulrich Muha was one courageous man who went there and said, look, I want to know about the past. And he did find out some quite painful things. He found out that four members of his theater group that are like a family to actors were actually just placed there in that theater group as actors to monitor him. He found out that he was on a special list of people who, in case of any kind of national emergency, would have been brought to special camps to be isolated from the rest of the population. He found out that his wife of 6 years, with whom he still had very good relations and a very beautiful daughter, had been listed as an informer with the Stasi, and that there were 500 pages of in her informer file, you know, including constant reminders to the Stasi that he must know nothing of this because he was an enemy of the Stasi. You know, these are things that were quite hard for him, but he'd lived through all that in the 90s. You know, when I offered this role to him, and I did not know about his past with the Stasi, because he is a very private man, I didn't know these things, but I somehow suspected from all the knowledge that he had of the Stasi. Most East Germans don't know that much about it. From the way how he knew that everything that I was telling in this film was accurate, that there must be something. And then as we became friends and as time passed, he told me more and more. And then I even convinced him to speak about these things, because I think that if you keep these kind of things just to yourself, it doesn't do you any good.
We're listening to Dave Davies' interview with Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, the director of the new German film The Lives of Others. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Dave Davies' interview with Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, the director of the new German film The Lives of Others. It's nominated for an Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. It's set in East Germany in the 80s and early 90s and is about the secret police and people they spied on.
There's a scene in this film that I found interesting where the Stasi captain, who is at the center of our story, is visited by a prostitute. And
I can see why you find that interesting.
Okay. Well, not so much because it's erotic. I don't know that it is. I mean, he begs her to stay, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that scene and what you were after.
I think that ideology makes people incredibly lonely. I think that's. It's one of those things you have to shut out all your feelings and you're just about the principle that you're pursuing. And in a way, I think that my character, the Stasi agent, realizes his loneliness as he experiences the lives of these artists. And he sees that people here have a connection to other people that he doesn't, and that he somehow isolated himself, but he doesn't even know about how to go about building that kind of bridge towards other people. And so he does what I think many people do in that kind of a situation. He just calls a prostitute. I think prostitution is illegal here in the U.S.
Most
it?
Places. But,
it's not in Germany. It's probably more part of our culture. I think it was less so in the East. But the Stasi actually had their own brothels. They actually also had prostitutes in their service, who would be used to compromise Westerners, whom they would then use as informers. So actually, prostitution and Stasi had a lot of things in common. Well, anyhow, he orders this prostitute, thinking that somehow she will give him what he's looking for. He's just somehow feeling these human urges in himself, but of course, you know, after that, he just feels lonelier than he ever has felt before.
And he begs her to stay a few minutes. She's on to another client. Mm-hmm. All right, right.
Yeah, and I know that person. She's a person who works as much on schedule as up to that point he's worked on schedule.
I know that you spent a lot of time researching the book, talking to ex-Stasi agents and victims of their surveillance. I mean, this film is fictional, but was there a kind of moment, an experience, a story that sort of crystallized this, you know, this kind of surveillance, this story that you think really informed the film?
Mm-hmm. I remember when I spoke to the Stasi officers, I always had to find a special technique to ask them without having them feel my judgment. Sometimes I actually felt a little hypocritical doing that, but at the same time, I knew that I would have the last word because I'd make that film, And that would be my answer. So I didn't have to show any moral outrage at the things they told me, because the film hopefully would show that. And I remember that, for example, when I had to find out about these odor samples, the Stasi actually took these odor samples so dogs would be able to identify who had been in contact with what, and then maybe even be able to find the dissidents. I had to find out how that worked and how people dealt with that, and whether it was something completely normal for them. So, of course, if I had now asked this person, the Stasi officer, these odor samples, did you really take them? Did you really do that? I think the conversation would have been over pretty soon. So I asked him instead, you know, these odor samples, did they really work? And that got him going. He said, yes, yes, absolutely. Those worked incredibly well.
Now, I want to clarify for the audience who hasn't seen the film, how did they actually collect an odor sample of someone who is being questioned?
There were two methods of collecting odor samples. The one was, if they didn't want you to notice, there was the so-called conspiratory odor sample, which was a cloth that looked like the cushion of a seat that you sat on while you were interrogated, and you would actually you would sweat, of course, while you were interrogated, and then they would be collected with gloves and put into a jar and locked airtight, so the odor would be kept. Another method, if they didn't have to keep it secret that they were keeping that odor sample, was that they would actually force you to take the cloth and wipe it between your legs and put it into the jar yourself. That was the more common method. And I asked him, did this actually work? And he said, yeah, it worked incredibly well. The dogs could always identify. Oh, no, actually. Then he said, I remember this one incident, it didn't work. There was a girl that we were interrogating, and she had her period, and there was just one drop of blood on that cloth, and the dogs were completely confused when I handed it to them. Ha, ha, ha. And he just suddenly started laughing. And then he said, well, you know, that's really weird. I haven't thought of that for, you know, like 20 years almost. No, so you're right. It didn't always work. You have to be careful of getting blood on there. So I just thought it was this really weird situation. I was sitting there in this guy's apartment, you know, a civilized apartment close to Hohenschönhausen. His wife was serving me tea. She, of course, had also been a Stasi worker, because they were only allowed to marry amongst each other from a certain level onwards. And, you know, on the wall there were framed pictures of the grandchildren, and that really made me think of that saying about the banality of evil. You know, it's one of those things that, and it also shows you how close barbarism and civilization really are next to each other, even in our countries.
I'm wondering what you did to capture the look, sound, and feel of East Germany in 1984. How you approached that?
That's a good question, because the question already implies something which I think is very true, that the Eastern Bloc did look and feel different. I think it had a lot to do with the colors, these somehow desaturated, washed out colors that the East had. There was something very unique about that. I even once spoke to a chemist who explained to me that there were certain patents that the East did not have, and therefore they couldn't make those bright neon colors that the West had. But I didn't simply want to do it by just washing out the colors or doing some lab trick. So I tried to analyze what colors were the most shockingly Western, and I actually found that it was red and blue. Those colors really throw you and seem very, very loud and extreme. And so I said, so looking at the pictures and films of Eastern Germany, I really saw that there wasn't so much blue. There was a little less blue. There was a little less red. And I went one step further and said, okay, well, look, let's eliminate blue and red altogether. And that's what I did. There's no blue object and no red object in the entire film. And I think it gives you that special feel. When we toured through the East with that film, people said, wow, this is exactly what it was like. And I think it's one of those cases where, again, fiction is somehow truer than fact. It doesn't look exactly like it looked, but it looks like we remember it, you know, because
right.
Things are made more intense in our memory.
And what about sound, music?
We used a lot of the authentic Eastern music from that time. It was a strange musical trip that I took listening to the music that was made behind the Iron Curtain, where people didn't have access to the kind of Western music that shaped music all over the place besides the Eastern Bloc. And for the film music, I managed to get my very favorite composer, Gabriel Yaret, who also wrote the music for The English Patient and for The Talented Mr. Ripley. I managed to convince him to write the music, and he wrote, I think, a score which really has such a strong message in it. When he wrote, for example, the Sonata for a Good Man, I said to him, look, imagine you can travel back to the year 1933 and get to spend 1.5 minutes with Hitler before he's committed his atrocities. And you somehow you were not allowed to talk to him. You weren't allowed to shoot him. You can just spend 1.5 minutes playing him a composition of yours on the piano. What are you going to play? And so he wrote this beautiful sonata, which plays a very central part in the film. And I think it somehow does contain that message.
Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck speaking with Dave Davies. Von Donnersmarck directed the new film The Lives of Others. It opens in New York and L.A. this Friday and will be followed by a national release. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, with a Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Harriet Jacobs's Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, in stores and online at bn.com. And from Anne and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching, at breakthroughcollaborative.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with director Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the new CD from Lily Allen, and we listen back to an interview with Frankie Lane, in which he talked about his Western themes like High Noon and Rawhide. Lane died yesterday at the age of 93. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about the new German film, The Lives of Others, which is nominated for an Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. It's set in East Germany in the 80s and early 90s, when the Stasi, the secret police, pressured informants to spy on friends, family, and neighbors. The story follows a Stasi captain and two famous artists he spies on. Let's get back to Dave Davies' interview with the film's director, Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck.
You know, I know a lot of German films in recent years have re-examined the Nazi experience from several different perspectives. And I gather this subject, I mean, the oppression and surveillance under the German Democratic Republic, East Germany, and the Stasi, really has not been covered by filmmakers so much. And I wonder why you think that is.
Well, I think you always need some distance from the things that you're describing. And it's only been, what is it, 17 years now since the fall of the wall. That's quite recent, the whole thing. I mean, think of how long it took for truly objective films about that time to be made in Germany. I don't know if we're making them now, but I do not think that a film like The Downfall would have been possible any earlier than, 60 years after 1945.
That was the film about Hitler in the bunker? Right?
Yeah, that's right. It was that film. It still caused quite an outrage in Germany, but I don't think that it would have been possible to make a film like that.
It's interesting because, I mean, I know that the East German experience, the German Democratic Republic, has not been ignored in German media, and I gather that there is something of a nostalgia in a lot of television shows about it. And I'm
wondering, that's true.
What is it that people miss about communist rule?
Yeah, you see, I think that people are actually a little bit confused because I don't think they're missing communism. What they're missing is the fact is their own youth in a way. You know, but it's so hard to tell those two things apart because while there was communism, they were young, so they think they're wanting communism back. Well, actually, they want their youth back. I think that's a large part of it. Another thing is, of course, there was a kind of social stability and security, or at least people perceived it to be that way. Wolf Biermann, the great East German poet, he once said, there's something incredibly attractive about the security and the stability of the life of a slave. And even going so far as to calling people their slaves. And I completely understand what he means. You know, it was also the fact that the GDR was living wealth beyond its own means. You know, the country when West Germany took over or when the country was unified was completely bankrupt.
I'm interested in the reaction you've gotten to the film and whether the reaction has differed in East Germany, the former East Germany, and the former West Germany.
I think in the East, the reaction was perhaps more directly emotional. In the West, people saw it more as an informative thriller and drama with political context content. In the East, people were, I think, moved on a deeper level. Very often after the screenings, and Ulrich Mühe and I toured through the East for about 2 weeks.
He was one of the lead actors, yeah.
Yeah, Ulrich Mühe, that's right. He's the actor who plays the Stasi agent. We toured through the East for 2 weeks when the film was released, and people would stay in there for hours afterwards, still sobbing and telling us how it reminded them of the things that they'd lived through. And very often they told us their own personal stories. And very often they would add at the end of their stories, this is the first time that we've told these stories to anybody. People have not really been wanting to think about the things that they suffered over the past 20 years. Often people would also come up to me and justify themselves for the things that they did. And I say, look, you don't have to justify yourself to me. I can't give you absolution. I'm not a priest. But I'm glad the whole thing made you think.
You know, this is your first feature film, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And it is a huge hit. It's won many, many awards and is nominated for many others. And so you're now at, I guess, age 34, right?
Close. Yeah, 33 still.
Okay, so you're now at age 33, a really hot director. I'm wondering what you're thinking of next and whether a directing in Hollywood appeals to you.
Yeah, Hollywood is appealing, of course, but I think that more important than the place where I work or where the financiers are is the topic. And I think it's very important to find something that you feel so passionate about. I have an entire filing cabinet full of ideas. When I'm done with all the festivals and interesting events surrounding this film, And I've set for myself as an arbitrary date the 2nd of May 2007, which is going to be my 34th birthday. I say after that I will never say the word Stasi again. But after that I'll try and look through all those things in real peace and quiet and try and see which of those topics really thrills me most, which do I think is most relevant to our times, most interesting, and then I'll start researching that. But you know, it'll probably take me many, many more years. I don't really understand how directors can make a film every year. Well, maybe they can if they don't write it for themselves. But there are even writer directors who just work so fast. I'm not like that. I have to research something for quite a long time before I feel that I have the essence of it, and before I can write confidently and feel that I'm saying something that deserves to be listened to.
Well, we'll wait patiently. Florian,
thanks.
Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Von Donnersmarck spoke with Dave Davies. Von Donnersmarck directed the new film, The Lives of Others. It opens in New York and L.A. this Friday and will later open nationally. Coming up, we listen back to an interview with Frankie Lane. He died yesterday at the age of 93. This is Fresh Air. Singer Frankie Lane died yesterday at the age of 93. He had his biggest hits in the 40s and 50s, like That's My Desire, Mule Train, Jezebel, and Ghost Riders in the Sky. He sold more than 100 million records. He had a big voice, and in addition to belting out pop tunes, he was famous for his theme songs to westerns.
Do not forsake me, oh my darling, on this our wedding day. Do not forsake me, oh my darling, wait along. There the outlaw band make their final stand. Okay, correct.
Keep moving, moving, moving. Oh, they're disapproving. Keep them doggies moving broad. Don't try to understand them. Just go through and brand them. Soon we'll be living high and wide.
Frankie Lane also made some fine jazz recordings. Here's a track from his 1955 album Jazz Spectacular, featuring trumpeter Buck Clayton and his orchestra.
Although you say we're through, I will always love you. You know you can depend on me. And if someone you've met has made you dear forget, you know that you can count on me. I wish you success, loads of happiness. Here I must confess, I will be lonely, I will be lonely, I will be so blue. But if you need a friend, I want to be yours until the very end, and you know you can depend on me.
I I spoke with Frankie Lane in 1987, and I asked him how an Italian boy from Chicago ended up singing cowboy songs.
In the beginning, I guess you might say that I was wondering what a city boy was doing singing country and western songs and Wild West themes. But apparently, I guess I was like any other kid who watched the cowboys and Indians movies. I was crazy about westerns. And maybe it all harks back to that. I really don't know, but it all seemed to come naturally, and I didn't seem to have any trouble adjusting to that genre of music. And I was crazy about some of the songs that came along. Some of them were pretty hokey, but things like Cool Water and Tumbling Tumbleweed were just fantastic for me vocally as far as interpreting them. And yet I never sounded exactly like a country singer in the sense of a Jim Reeves or any of those guys.
You know, I remember whenever I used to see you on the Ed Sullivan Show, I used to always hope that you'd sing Rawhide. And the times I saw you, you never did. So I guess I wonder if you've ever included that as part of your repertoire and performances.
Well, part of the deal on Rawhide entailed the proviso that I had to record the song first and that it had to be out at least 8 weeks prior to the TV show going on the air, which it was. And I was glad because by the time the TV show did debut, the record was a smash and it was fighting for the number one spot. In fact, the producers themselves told me later that the theme song, the popularity of the Rawhide record, kept the TV show on the air for about 4 months, and everybody laughs when I tell them that in the show that I do now. And then I say the TV show caught on and kept me on the air for 7.5 years, so it turned out to be good for both of us.
No, I wouldn't laugh, because even when the reruns came on just a couple of years ago, I would tune it in just to hear the theme song.
Well, there you go.
Did you enjoy the opportunity of doing a send-up of all of your Western themes when Mel Brooks asked you to do Blazing Saddles, the theme from his Western spoof, Blazing Saddles?
I have to confess, Terry, that I was a complete dummy about that whole situation. I was working in Vegas at the time, and I happened to do a Merv Griffin guest shot, and I didn't know that anybody was watching who would be involved in filming a movie at that time or had just filmed a movie. Now, I get a call only about 20 minutes after the show went off the air from Mel Brooks, and I thought it was a gag. And I didn't know too much about Mel Brooks at that time. And he said, "I'm Mel Brooks, and I'm producing a picture called Blazing Saddles, and we have a theme song that we would like for you to do." And nobody told me that this picture was a comedy or a takeoff. I did it absolutely dead sure certain serious. And then I was stunned when I saw the preview. I happened to be in, we were touring somewhere, and they had a preview of the movie, and I almost died when I realized that I was part of a big comedy setup, and I got ribbed about it an awful lot. But he said later, he says, "That's why we didn't tell you." He says, "We wanted you to do it dead serious."
He rode a blazing saddle, he wore a shining star. His job to offer battle to bad men near and far. He conquered fear and he conquered hate. He turned dark night into day. He made his blazing saddle a torch to light the way.
It's kind of ironic that you, one of the men with the biggest voices in pop music, was discovered by a man with one of the kind of smallest voices in singing. And I'm thinking of Hoagy Carmichael, who was a wonderful songwriter and a wonderful singer, and whose style of singing I think of as being very different from yours. What's the story of how he first heard you?
Well, I was hanging around a little joint called Billy Berg's in the middle 40s, like 45 and 46. And Billy, who ran the place, was a good friend of mine and used to let me get up and sing every once in a while with whoever was headlining there. And one night I happened to pick Rockin' Chair, and it was a jazz joint in those days, so I always sang something in that vein. And I didn't know that the composer, Hoagy Carmichael, was going to be sitting out there that night. And after I finished, to a nice, polite round of applause, I started to walk off the stage. I put my glasses back on, and there was this guy at the bottom of the steps waiting to talk to me. He says, what's your name? I told him. He says, where are you working? I says, I'm not. He says, well, come with me. So he took me over to Billy. He says, Billy, why don't you put this kid to work? He sings great. And Billy laughed, and he says, what for? He comes in and sings every night for nothing. But he did put me to work, and that was the beginning of the whole thing.
I think most of your listeners are most familiar with your pop music hits. One of your albums that I like best is of you singing jazz standards with an orchestra led by trumpeter Buck Clayton. And it's a side of you that I think probably a lot of people are not familiar with. I wonder how come you headed in the pop direction instead of staying in jazz-style singing.
Well, a lot of it was pure accident. While I was working at Billy Berg's, a guy by the name of Edgar Hayes came to work there headlining as a small quartet that really I used to use them to sing with me, to back me up while I was doing the intermission singing. And I happened to ask him if he remembered an old tune called That's My Desire. He says, no, but that's a great tune. He says, I think it'd be good for you. To my complete surprise, after I finished the song, there was absolute pandemonium. And Billy Berg's wife came running up and said, Frank, do it again. So that night I did it 5 times, and that night changed my life. So that is a pop song. So all of a sudden, I get a hit with a pop version of an old tune, and it just carried me in that direction. And that's how I got laid in that slot. And no matter how many jazz things I did after that, nobody would really ever accept me as a jazz singer. So you figure it out.
Well, I'm thrilled that you're still performing, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us, Frankie Lane.
Okay, thank you, doll. Bye.
Frankie Lane recorded in 1987. He co-wrote a wonderful song with pianist and bandleader Carl Fischer called We'll Be Together Again. Here's Lane with Fischer's orchestra performing that song in 1947.
No tears, no fears. Remember there's always tomorrow. So what if we have to part? We'll be together again. Your kiss, your smile, our memories I'll treasure forever. So try thinking with your heart, and we'll be together again. And when I know you'll be lonesome, times when I know you'll be sad, surround you. Don't let the blues make you bad. Someday, some way, we both have a lifetime before us. For partying is not goodbye, and we'll be together again. We will be
Frankie Lane. He died yesterday at the age of 93. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Lily Allen's CD, All Right Still, which was a big hit in Europe and has just been released in the U.S. This is Fresh Air. Lily Allen is a 21-year-old British singer who spent the last year storming up the record charts in Europe with songs from her debut album called All Right Still. That album was released here last week, but her popular website had already received 6 million hits. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
That's Lily Allen singing in a deceptively chirpy tone about urban misfortune. Riding her bike around London, she witnesses a mugging and a pimp punishing a prostitute. Yet the music maintains a perky ska reggae rhythm, a horn section bleats jauntily, Lily croons charmingly. This is Allen's basic strategy, remaining plucky and upbeat despite being surrounded by annoyances or worse.
All right, so this is a song about anyone. It could be anyone. You're just doing your own thing and someone comes out of the blue. They're like, all right, what are you saying? Yeah, can I take your digits? And you're like, no, not in a million years. You're nasty. Please leave me alone. Cut to the pub on a last night out. Man at the bar because it was his shout. Clocks his bird and she looked okay. She caught him looking and walked his way.
Was thinking about buying one for your friend.
She's got no taste, hand on his waist, tries to pull away, but her lips on his face.
If you insist, I'll have a white wine spritzer.
Sorry, love, but you ain't a pretty picture.
Can't knock him out, you can't walk away. Try desperately to think of the place.
You can hear what I mean there about Lily Allen's spunkiness in the midst of boorish behavior. The poor girl can't even go out with her mates to a pub without being harassed. What comes across with glowing heat and the occasional pungent obscenity is that our Lily knows how to give as good as she gets. Listen to this amusing litany of the guy's flaws and her threats to his persistence.
Please don't come around and knock on my door, 'cause I don't wanna have to pick you up off the floor. When you ask if we can still be lovers, I'll have to introduce my brothers. I think that they can teach you a lesson or two. By the time they're finished, you'll be black and blue. You'll be crying like a baby. A sea of tears, they'll call the Navy. Don't take me on, no.
This 21-year-old tough cookie has become the toast of London, and for months before her album's official American release, you could download songs from All Right Still from her MySpace.com page and read her feisty blog postings. This is one new model for becoming a pop star. And overseas, Allen's openness has made this song, Smile, a number one hit.
Smile. Yeah, it makes me smile.
Lily Allen's influences include not just ska and reggae and Spice Girl-flavored pop, but also New Orleans second-line rhythm and Phil Spector girl group gothic grandeur. She presents a cheerful, even vehement positivism that gives her demands for respect, her contempt for authority, a wallop.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed All Right Still by Lily Allen. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I don't want us to have a fight, but in the background I can hear you chanting shy. I hear it every night. And you think you're being really cool, and you've been doing it since we were both at school. Now who looks like the fool?
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Adopted Son, A Story of Washington, Lafayette, and the Friendship That Saved the Revolution by David A. Clary. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, sponsoring Philadelphia's new audio walking tours called Sound About Philly at soundaboutphilly.com. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Mark Wahlberg. He's been nominated for an Oscar for his role in the film The Departed. Wahlberg's other movies include Boogie Nights, Rockstar, Three Kings, Four Brothers, and Invincible. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.